Yannis and Matthew for giving me the honor of coming and giving a few lectures here. So the one thing that I'd like to mention is that earlier I was planning to talk about just symbolic bound computation and our approach for solving this problem. But then while working on the slides, it was quite an educational experience for me too, and I realized that lots of principles that we were using behind solving this particular problem might have more general applicability too. And therefore, I try to distill those principles under the category art of invariant generation for lack of any fundamental principles behind this. And I hope that even if you're not specifically interested in the problem of symbolic bound computation, you might still find these principles useful to apply to other applications. And the second thing that I'd like to mention is that these lectures have more of an algorithmic flavor to them. But since I also want to cover a wide variety of techniques, so I will mostly be giving you intuition about those algorithms rather than going to details of correctness and computational complexities of those algorithms. And I would also love if we can make this interactive. So here is the outline of this lecture series. So first I'm going to motivate and formally define the problem of symbolic bound computation and show how it reduces to invariant generation. And then as part of invariant generation techniques, I've listed down three dimensions, one of which I would be covering today. And I'll talk about fixed point techniques tomorrow. And then day after, I will talk about program transformations and then conclude by seeing how we can apply most of these principles that we have studied back to the problem of symbolic bound computation. So this problem is motivated by observing that programs, when they run, they consume several physical resources. So one of the key resources is the processor time. And quite often you have hard constraints on getting some task to be executed, especially in real-time systems. And you would want to ideally bound the amount of time that your program takes to run, and in fact to respond to certain external event. Another such physical resource that programs use is memory. And oftentimes you're running programs on, say, embedded systems which have a finite amount of memory to run a particular application. And you would like to know beforehand what is the upper bound on the amount of memory that your application would require. Programs that deal with network sends out traffic on the network, and you would also like to bound the amount of traffic that your program is creating. And nowadays, when power is becoming important, we would also like to bound how much power is your particular application consuming. And bounding these kinds of resources requires answering a fundamental question. And this question is that given a control location in your program that actually consumes these resources, what is the worst case bound on the number of times a given control location in your program can be executed? So another place where answering this question becomes important is after you realize that even program execution even affects the quantitative properties of the data that it manipulates. So for example, some operation in your program might be leaking some information about the secret data in your program. But the amount of information that is leaked per execution of a given instruction is tiny. But when you execute that instruction several times, then it leaks. Overall, it leaks quite a bit of information about your program. So if you want to quantify that, you need to know how many times that instruction was executed. Another such interesting property is in domains where your program is running and taking data from the environment that can have a small amount of errors or uncertainties. So for example, the application that runs on, say, sensor networks, if one of the sensor networks goes bad, then it is giving you some small error in the reading that it is taking. And we would like to know whether your software is robust with respect to those small errors or not. So if you make some small errors in your inputs, is the output also only a little bit different from the ideal output? And this is what I'm defining as robustness. And again, answering these kinds of questions would require you to answer the question, how many times is a certain operation that essentially adds up these errors gets executed? And even for the earlier motivation that I talked about, like bounding different kinds of resources, and here I'm talking about bounding different kinds of quantitative properties, So all these things requires answer to the fundamental question of how many times is a certain control location visited. But an answer to this question is by no means giving you a solution to these problems. So you need to do a lot more. But at least you need to address this fundamental question of bounding the number of times a given control location is actually executed. And we are especially interested in computing a bound on this statically. And one advantage of that is that we can actually provide immediate feedback to a developer in an interactive code development environment. So this often happens when a developer is debating between choice of different APIs that can be used to accomplish the same task. But those APIs can have different resource usage characteristics. So for example, some API might be more efficient in terms of time, but might take more memory. And if we can annotate all those APIs with the resource consumption, then the developers can make informed decisions about which API to use to accomplish a certain task. And another scenario is that of code editing. So let's say a developer has written some code and also verified its resource usage properties, and then they make small changes to their code. We would like to again ascertain the fact that the resource usage of the program is again within desirable bounds. And the other advantage that static analysis is going to give you, and in particular if you compute worst case bounds, is that we will be able to identify several corner cases which you are otherwise likely to miss if you use some dynamic testing techniques, like you simply profile the program on a given set of test inputs. Then the resource consumption that you will measure on a given test input is only as good as the set of test inputs on which you run your program. But a static computation of worst case bounds is going to take care of all the corner cases. So let me now formally define this problem of symbolic bound computation. So I'm given a control location inside a procedure P, which has a set of inputs X. And let visits of X denote the number of visits to this control location when the procedure P is invoked with some inputs. Now, we want to find a closed form expression on visits of X. So in particular, we want an integer valued expression, which I'm calling B of X, which is a bound on visits of X. So visits of X denotes the exact number of visits, which would be difficult to provide for any procedure. Instead, what we are just hoping for is some kind of closed form solution that can bound visits of X. And this is what I'm calling B of X. Now for a given procedure and a given, yeah, go ahead.
Example you gave where you're trying to bound the time or the accuracy of some certain output?
So, for example, the program is taking data from the environment where some input values can have small amounts of errors in them, or they may be away from the real value. And now, if let's say I'm running let's take the example of like shortest path computation, right? And I'm trying to, so this shortest path computation runs on a graph where there are nodes and the edge represents the distance between these nodes. And this distance, for example, may even reflect the physical distance or let's say, you know, the amount of traffic that is flowing between those two nodes. And I'm measuring this data with some physical instruments, and those instruments may not be perfect. So they can return me some values which is slightly away from the actual value. And now the question that I want to answer is that is the output of the shortest path algorithm going to be hugely different from the actual output if I had the ideal values for all the inputs? So if the inputs can change only by a slight amount, can I prove that the output is only going to change again by a slight amount? So this is a Boolean version of the problem. But then the quantitative version of the problem essentially involves saying if the input edge weights are affected by a small amount delta, what is the maximum value by which the output can get affected? So in order to answer this question, I would need to compute bounds on the location in the program which actually adds up the errors in this computation. So for a given procedure and a given control location, you might be able to compute multiple bounds. So one bound would be more precise than the other if for all inputs it is less than or equal to the other bound.
How you can measure this bound? You can test it on all outputs, right?
So So I can use some analytical methods to check this thing. So for example, if I compute a bound of x, let's say x is an input, and if I compute a bound of x for a procedure, it's certainly more precise than computing a bound of x squared. So a procedure might be linear, but because of undecidability issues, I might only be able to compute a quadratic bound on the procedure. So I would say that the linear bound is actually more precise than quadratic. Right? Or if you give me a bound of 2x, it's going to be more precise than a bound of, say, 3x. So this is how I define relative precision. It's defined with respect to two bounds. So there can be multiple answers to this problem. Right? So now the question that I would like to put on the floor is that what can be the notion of an absolutely precise bound? The real bound, yeah, absolutely, right? Now, the problem is that it might not be possible for you to come up with closed-form solutions that reflect the exact number of visits to a given control location. And there's actually another problem with that definition, right? So, for example, my program might, on some execution, it can take a linear amount of time. On some other condition on the inputs, it can take a quadratic amount of time. So what would be the notion of a bound for this? I cannot say that the bound is linear, because on some inputs, it takes a quadratic amount of time. Right? So if I say that the bound is quadratic, then I want to give a feeling that the bound is really precise. But if I want to say that the bound is cubic, right, which is a correct answer, but not a precise answer. Okay? So here is how I have tried to formalize the notion of a bound being precise. So if you give me a bound, I would call it precise if there exists a worst-case family of inputs, which is what I'm calling W of x, that realizes this bound up to some constant factors. So there should exist a family Wx such that ideally B of x should be equal to visits of x. But such a bound would be very hard to compute. A closed-form solution would be very hard to compute. Therefore, I'm allowing some leeway with some multiplicative constant factors and additive constant factors here. And this would essentially ensure that the bound B of x is asymptotically tight. So there's one other condition that I need for this bound to make sense, and that condition is that the family W of x should essentially be an infinite family, which means that for every integer k greater than or equal to 0, there should exist some x in this family whose bound is actually greater than or equal to the input k. So the assignment actually gives you, the first question in the assignment gives you three procedures, for each of which the bound is actually n. So n is the correct bound for each of the three procedures. So let's say that my goal is to bound the number of loop iterations. But for some of these procedures, the bound is precise, and for some, it is not. And for the procedures for which it is precise, we want to find a precision witness for each of those procedures. And this W of x is what I'm calling a precision witness. So this is a worst-case family of inputs. So can you identify for which procedures is the bound precise and for which procedures it is not precise? So according to this definition of precision. So let's pick up example procedure P1, right? So can you identify a family W of x that satisfies the first condition for procedure P1? Actually, so I'm sorry, there's a typo in this first problem. So instead of n greater than or equal to 100, it should be n less than or equal to 100. So your answer would be then n less than or equal to 100 probably, right? So that's correct. So n less than or equal to 100 describes the family that satisfies condition number 1. But unfortunately, it does not satisfy condition number 2. Because the reason is that I can never achieve a bound of 101. In fact, the precise bound for this constant 100. So n is the correct bound, but 100 is also a correct bound. And 100 is a precise bound, but n is not a precise bound. Because the family should be such that it should be possible to get increasingly larger evaluations to the bound function b of x. Okay, similarly, procedure p2, so n is the bound for this procedure, and is this bound precise? Can you identify a family which just satisfies condition 1? So for what condition on the inputs n and m will you realize the bound of n? N less than m, that's correct, yes. And n less than m also satisfies this condition because it allows you to choose increasingly larger values for n. It does not restrict n in any way. So n less than m is a precision witness. And similarly for procedure p3, can you identify a family w of x? Maybe someone else than Rishab? Except you too. So under what conditions on n do I get a bound of n on procedure p3? Yeah, exactly, when n is even. And does that condition satisfy the second condition too? It does, because you can increasingly choose larger values for n which are even. Okay. There exists some input. So ideally, you know, this is the thing that I first wrote down when I was preparing this. But then I realized that x is not necessarily integer inputs. So x can be any data structure, or it can be anything. So I cannot really assume any total order on x. Right? So x is just some input which belongs to this family, but the bound on x should be greater than or equal to k. Okay? Because I could have also written this definition as saying, so there was no need for me to refer to k, but I could have just referred to x itself. But the problem is that x is not necessarily an integer input. In all these examples, it is. But x can also be a list or it can be a tree. And you cannot assume a total ordering on all those data structures. So let's take an example. Maybe I should have just done this example, not the one in the assignment. Okay. So in this example, we have two nested loops. The first loop goes from 0 to n, and the other loop kind of goes from j equals I plus 1 to n if this if condition is not taken. Now, I have identified two control locations here, pi 1 and pi 2. So pi 1 is the immediately inside the second loop, and pi 2 is in the true branch of the if conditional. And now we want to compute bounds on the number of times pi 1 is executed and pi 2 is executed. So can you give me a bound on the number of times the control location pi 1 is executed? Did someone say n square? Yes, so n square is a correct answer. And in fact, I can also tell you that it is a precise bound. So good. Can you also tell me a bound on the number of times the control location pi 2 is visited? So n square is a correct answer, but it is not a precise answer. You can give a more precise answer. So let's say that the array is of length n, but it does not really matter. So it will still remain n square. And the reason why it is important for me to be able to compute precise bounds on pi 2 is because it is consuming some resource, and I do not want to give false positives to the user. So if I'm telling you that n square is not a precise answer, it probably got to be n, which it is, because you observe that the value of n is also decrementing each time I execute the consume resource method. So it's not easy, but towards the end of the class on the third day, we should be in a situation that we should be able to apply automated techniques to compute a precise bound of n for this control location pi 2. So why don't you try this thing, you know, work this thing out and confirm that the number of times pi 2 is visited is at most n. And most of the examples that I'm going to take are from real code. So this is, you know, some real code that we found in .NET based class libraries. So n square is a precise bound for pi 1, and what's the precision witness for n square? So we want the else branch to be always taken. So the witness is such that a of j should be always false. So this is essentially the precision witness. And you can also work out these constants. And n is a precise bound for number of visits to pi 2, and the precision witness is actually completely opposite, actually. So if you want the pi 2 location to be executed the maximum number of times, then pi 1 will not be executed the maximum number of times. In fact, the precision witness is completely opposite for the two. Okay, now that we have an idea about what this problem is all about, so let's see, you know, how can we solve it, and can we use some existing technology to solve this problem? So if we recall what a safety prop, so how many people know what safety and liveness properties are? Okay, so actually that thing is not very important either, but I will just try to contrast the current problem that we have had at hand and tell you that it is actually different from safety and liveness properties. So safety property is like saying, given a control location, we want to prove that this location is never visited, because that location has some error, maybe some array is being accessed, and the index is probably going out of bounds. So we want to make sure that the control location is never visited. And this is what we call a safety property. And another definition for a safety property is that its violation should be some kind of finite trace that shows you that the location pi is visited. In contrast, a liveness property asks, one form of liveness property is that given a control location, is it only visited finite number of times? And here a violation would be one that visits the control location pi an infinite number of times. Now in contrast, the bound computation problem is actually asking you to give you a bound on the maximum number of times a given control location is visited. Now clearly this is different from safety and liveness, because this is a quantitative question. This is not a Boolean question. So to be more fair, let's try to change the question slightly. So let's say I'm given a bound. And now I want to check whether this is indeed a bound, which is what I'm referring to as validity of a bound. And secondly, I want to check whether the bound is precise. So can you tell me whether the problem of checking, let's say, the validity of a bound, is that a safety problem or a liveness problem? If I give you the bound, then can you check if it is a correct bound? Is that a safety problem or a liveness problem? Or none of these? So it turns out that it's a safety property, because all that you can do is you can just introduce a counter to count the number of times pi is visited, and you can assert that the value of this counter is always less than or equal to this bound, right? So checking that a bound is given bound is valid is actually a safety property. But checking whether a bound is precise or not, how about that? Is this a safety property or a liveness property? Can you try to answer this question assuming that you have oracles that can answer those two kinds of questions? The safety and liveness. So let's say you have a perfect oracle for answering safety properties and a perfect oracle for answering liveness properties. Can you answer this question? So let's say you are given a bound and it's a correct bound, and now you want to check whether the bound is precise or not.
If with liveness and then check how many times it's visited, you can check the precision.
So liveness will give you a Boolean answer, yes or no, whether some location is visited a finite number of times or not.
Yes.
This slide was motivated by the question that you asked at PLDI, because I want to tell you that this computing, checking whether a bound is precise or not, is a very difficult problem. And I will not even attempt that in this set of lecture series. So this is not even a trace property, which means that, so normally a violation of safety and liveness can be provided to you by giving a trace. If I give you a trace, you know, that visits pi, you know, then you have proved that, you know, safety is violated. In case of liveness, I can give you a trace that visits pi infinite amount of times, then that property is violated. But this is not even a trace property. And the reason is that this, you know, you're not looking for a one particular, you know, input that exhibits the bound. You're looking for an infinite family of inputs that exhibit the bound. So because of this, this is not even a trace property. So again, if you feel get lost, you know, don't bother about it, because the only point that I want to make is that this particular problem is actually quite hard. But if you're given the precision witness, which is this family of worst case family of inputs, then checking that the bound is in fact realized is a safety property. but only when you're given the precision witness. Because if you want to check whether a bound is precise or not, one big thing that you have at hand is to identify this worst case family of inputs, which is not so easy. So therefore, in this set of lectures, I will only focus on computing some bound, but I will tell you analytically that for all the interesting examples that we have come across, our techniques is able to compute a precise bound. But we do not have an automated technique to check whether a bound is precise or not. So this is an open problem, and I do not know of any solution that has been presented about this problem. So as I said earlier, that there are different solutions that are possible, and in fact, these solutions form a simple lattice with less than or equal to as a partial order. So if you know two different bounds for a problem, you can take the min of them, and that will be a more precise bound. But instead, what I'm going to show you is how to reduce this problem of bound computation to invariant generation. And the idea is that the more powerful the invariant generation tool that you use, the more precise the bound that you will get. So now we are in a situation where we want to use the most powerful invariant generation that we have at hand. And I will show you how this problem reduces to invariant generation. So therefore, for the better half of this lecture series, we'll study design of some relevant invariant generation tools that can be used to compute invariants that are required for computing bounds. But I'm hoping that these are general principles that you will find useful for other applications besides just bound computation. So let me show you how does bound computation reduces to invariant generation. So let's assume that you have this program where S1, S2, S3 are not necessarily just sequential statements. You can have jumps and so on. So just some portion of code. And there's this control location pi. And this program takes as one input n. And you want to compute the number of times the control location pi is visited. So what we can simply do is to introduce a counter, C, that is initialized to 0 at the beginning, and I increment this counter by 1 every time the control location pi is executed. And now this claim is not difficult to actually prove, that if the value of counter C is less than some function of n, if you can establish a fact of this form, if you can establish a fact of this form as an invariant at control location pi, then you can conclude that max of 0, fn is a bound on the number of times pi is visited. Now, there are two subtle issues in this claim, even though it looks quite simple. And the assignment asks you to verify one such subtle issue, and one I will do it now. So two subtle issues are that why is max important? Why don't I just say, f of n is a bound on visits of pi? So I will explain the subtleness of this claim on the next slide. But there's another subtle issue here. It says if this is an invariant at pi, as opposed to an invariant, say, at the end of the program, so then also things would go wrong. And the assignment asks you to work out this. So what would go wrong if I change this claim to say if this is an invariant at the end of the program? Right? Then that's an incorrect claim, and you are asked to provide an example of why this is incorrect. But let me actually tell you why putting a max is important here. All of them will give you bounds. You take all the bounds you can get and take min of all those bounds. So good question, yeah. So there are going to be multiple possible answers, yeah. But the most precise answer is only going to be one. So it's not clear if you can get that or not. But if you can compute two difference, so for some examples we can, then you can just take the min. So this procedure P2 provides an excellent example. So for procedure P2, you can prove that n is a bound. You can also prove that m is a bound. Therefore, min of n, m is also a bound. So let me tell you why this, putting max of 0, comma was important, right?
So is there going to be a hint about the second claim, or will we just have to think about it?
Yeah, so why don't you try to think about it? So I'm going to explain you one subtle issue in this claim, which is why am I taking max? And the other subtle issue is why do I care about invariant at pi as, say, opposed to end of the program? It looks mostly correct. It is mostly correct, except that there is one corner case. So why don't you think about that corner case, and then we can chat about it, in the next two lectures. So I'm only going to cover one subtle aspect in this rule, which is why am I taking max of 0, something. So a corollary of the previous claim is that instead of computing bounds for any control location, let's say I'm only interested in computing bounds for a given loop. Then all that I have to do is to establish that C is less than fn is a loop invariant, and then say that max of 0, fn is an upper bound on number of loop iterations. So this is a correct corollary. But now let's say that if we change this corollary slightly, and instead claim that fn is a bound on the number of loop iterations instead of max of 0, fn. So let's see what would go wrong. So consider this simple test procedure in which counters are already there, so I don't need to instrument the counters. Right? The first loop has a counter C1, the second loop has a counter C2, so counter instrumentation is not really required. Now, C1 is less than N1 is a loop invariant. Does everyone agree? So how many people agree that C1 is less than N1 is a loop invariant for the first loop? It is a loop invariant, so everyone should agree. Okay. Now suppose we regard N1 to be an upper bound for the first loop instead of max of 0, N1. Similarly, for the second loop, we can conclude that N2 is an upper bound on the number of iterations of the second loop. Now let me take the liberty of concluding that N1 plus N2 is an upper bound for the number of steps that this procedure executes. So do people buy that? If I have two code fragments in sequence, and if the first code fragment takes U1 steps, the second code fragment takes U2 steps, then the total steps is U1 plus U2. So everyone should agree, this is the correct remark too. Therefore, N1 plus N2 will be an upper bound for test procedure, right? Now, what happens when I run this procedure with N1 equals 100 and N2 equals minus 100? Right? I will get a bound of 0. Clearly, this procedure does not run in 0 steps. So this is a subtle issue, but one needs to be careful about this, and we'll see the importance of this max, you know, towards the end of the lecture. So let's take an example of how we can compute a bound for a slightly more non-trivial procedure. So can someone tell me the bound for this procedure? So it has one input n, and it starts with two temporary variables, x and y, initialized to 0 and n respectively. And then in each loop iteration, either it increments x by 2 or it decrements y by 2. So what is the bound on the number of loop iterations for this example? Max of 0, n by 2, yes. So let's see how we can compute this automatically. So we instrument a counter C. We'll use an invariant generation tool, and let's say that the tool can compute this invariant for us. So why is this a correct loop invariant? So x is less than y is trivial to observe. It's trivial to observe that it holds at control location pi. And the reason why this is true is because the value of C increases in, so the value of C is correlated with x, y, and n. So you can verify that this is an inductive loop invariant. Now, since we want the bound to be only in terms of the program inputs, we have to project out x and y. And if we project out x and y, you get this invariant C is less than n by 2. And from here, you can simply read off the bound. So max of 0, n by 2 is an upper bound on the number of times the loop is executed. So this is essentially our overall methodology. So are we done? Like, shall we go home? Have we solved the problem? Well, no, because as I said, that computing these invariants is going to be very hard in general. Why? So before I tell you that, let's take a moment and go back to what is it that we want to compute. We want to compute a bound, right? But we did not even discuss the language of these bounds. Like, what language are you going to use to describe these bounds? So one thing that is important to observe is that the bound is going to use the max operator. And we clearly saw examples of such bounds. And the reason why it ends up using the max operator is mostly because you have control flow in your programs. And there's a choice between execution of different paths. You will also need the addition operator to express your bounds. This especially happens because of sequencing. You will need nonlinear operators to express bounds, such as multiplication, which will be the case when you have nested loops. You will need logarithm if you are doing binary search in your loops. You will need exponentiation if you have recursive procedures like Fibonacci, which are written without memoization. Furthermore, you would need some quantitative attributes when loops iterate over data structures. For example, you need to refer to the number of nodes in an input list or a list of lists, number of nodes in a tree or a height of a tree, or even the number of bits in a bit vector. So even to express your bounds for simple programs that you would see in real life, you would need all these operators. And clearly, to the invariants that you would need to compute such a bound will also involve all these things. You need nonlinear invariants. You would need disjunctive invariants. You would need invariants that refer to numerical properties of data structures. So all the hard things. And unfortunately, a universal, precise invariant generator tool that can discover invariants which are nonlinear, disjunctive, and refer to properties of heaps does not exist. Therefore, now we'll actually take a break from this problem. and study some principles of invariant generation for the complete, you know, the next lecture and the half of the third lecture. And then we will come back and apply the various principles that we have learned and to actually solve this problem. Right, so is everyone convinced that I've shown you that, you know, a good bound computation can be done if you have a good invariant generation tool available? And the kinds of invariants that you need are the ones that can that are like nonlinear, disjunctive, and refer to numerical properties of heaps. And all these are three things are quite hard. So you know, this is my take at most of the work that I you know, as I understand, in the area of invariant generation. So I feel that this has three main steps. So one step is, you know, what people may also call, you know, several heuristics, which turn out to be quite important in the form of transforming a given program such that you're reducing the need for sophisticated invariant generation. So what you do is you take the original program, you want to generate a sophisticated invariant for that program, you transform the program to some other program and generate some simple invariants for the transformed program. Now, the simple invariants for the transformed program can be mapped back to sophisticated invariants on the original program. And I will give you several examples in this category. But the first thing that I will actually start with is logic, the language of invariants, or the language of the formulas that you use to describe your invariants and the decision procedures to reason about them. This is good enough if all that you want to do is to verify given invariants. But if you have to automatically discover invariants, you have to compute fixed points to equations. And then you need tools which can do more than what decision procedure typically does in order to be able to generate automatic loop invariants. And for that, you have several choices. So you first fix your logic, the operators that you want to compute invariants over. And then you also fix whether you want to compute conjunctive invariants or disjunctive invariants or invariants over a given predicate set of predicates. And the challenge is to be able to automatically compute these invariants. So the second lecture will primarily be entirely focused on fixed point computation techniques. I'm going to talk about three techniques in detail there. But let me actually start with logic.
So in which situations can you cannot make any inference on the loop invariant?
So in which situation do we make? So I'm sorry, I did not understand your question.
I mean, given the program, there should be situations for which you shouldn't be able to.
Yes. So
which are such situations?
So in general, precise loop invariance is an undecidable problem.
Sure. Right?
But what I will try to show you, you know, through this approach is that you need to understand the domain of programs for which you are generating invariance, as well as the domain of properties that you want to prove about those programs. So in our particular case, one basic idea that we have is that we want to compute invariants that are nonlinear, that are disjunctive, and that can refer to numerical properties of heap. And based upon that observation, I can make some choices of which invariant generation technique do I want to use. So this first technique is really a program-to-program transformation technique. So what I'll show you is that in some cases, you can actually avoid the need for generating nonlinear invariants and disjunctive invariants in the first place. So what you do is you transform a program to some other program, and then you can use some simple invariant generation tools, off-the-shelf tools, to compute simple properties of that program, which can then be mapped back to nonlinear invariants and disjunctive invariants. But this is not always possible. So you, of course, also need techniques that can directly compute disjunctive invariants, so I'll also talk about that. But regardless, you also need to fix a language in which you're going to describe your invariants, which is also known as abstract domain. Whether your invariants are going to talk about heap, or they're only going to talk about the properties of arithmetic variables, or maybe the properties of bit vector variables, or the properties of lists, arrays, I'll show you lots of examples there. You need to fix that logic, that language. Once you fix a language, you also need a decision procedure to reason about formulas in that language, and I will define formally what a decision procedure is. So fixing a language and picking up a decision procedure is good enough only to verify a given invariant, not to automatically generate it. To automatically generate an invariant, you need more than decision procedures. You need something that can compute fixed points. And there also we have lots of choices, and I will give you examples of that. So the first thing that you do when you, you know, do invariant generation is to see if any program transformation techniques are applicable. that will help reduce the dependence upon sophisticated invariant generation. Then you choose a logic in which you want to express your invariance. It's like choosing an abstract domain. And then you choose your fixed point strategy. Yeah, there will be several programs. You know, this is an undecidable problem. So whatever technique you come up with, there will always be programs for which you cannot generate invariance, the desired invariance.
So when I want to use your tools, how do I know that I will get an answer?
So you need to be a good. You need to have a good feeling about you know what your domain is about and what is the kind of invariance that you need to generate. So what I will do is that in the third lecture, so today and in the second lecture, we'll study several principles, and then I will work with you to decide how to, you know, choose different logics, how to choose different fixed point computation techniques. And in fact, the solution that we come up with will be using iterative fixed point for some part, constraint-based fixed point for some part, and proof rules-based fixed point computation for some other part in the problem. So that is just a heuristic choice that we have made, but we observed by experiments, by doing 3 years of research on this, that this particular combination works best. So you need to do a lot of experimentation to figure out what would work well or not. In fact, this is exactly the plan that I wanted to have for showing you this. First, I wanted to tell you some basic principles that we know from recent literature, and then exactly the question that you're asking, that how should I go about choosing which of these things? So which is what we will do as an exercise in the third lecture. So, and the specific reason why I have chosen these particular logics to explain are because reasoning about all these logics is required to compute bounds even for you know, simple standard programs, because programs use arithmetic iterators, they iterate over arrays, they iterate over lists, and you have nested loops which require reasoning about nonlinear arithmetic. So this has essentially motivated me to come up to discuss these particular logics. So what you're going to study is a decision procedure for all these different logics. So what exactly is a decision procedure? So decision procedure is an algorithm that takes as input a formula phi and returns yes if and only if the formula phi is satisfiable. So without loss of generality, we can assume that the formula phi is a conjunction of ground facts in this theory. So why is that a without loss of generality assumption? Yes, so the satisfiability checking easily distributes over disjunctions. So we can convert a formula phi into DNF form, and we can check whether each of the formulas is individually satisfiable or not. And if any one of those formulas is individually satisfiable, I say that the original formula phi is satisfiable. Therefore, for the purpose of our discussion, we are going to limit our reasoning to decision procedures that only take as input a conjunction of atomic facts or ground facts in that theory. But what is the trade-off if I decide to use this approach for checking satisfiability? Yes, and that's usually an exponential blow-up, right? So if you want to design a satisfiability procedure for a formula that has Boolean structure, maybe you want to integrate the Boolean reasoning in a more integrated fashion with your decision procedure for a conjunction of facts. But that is something that is quite can be done in quite generic way, but we're not going to talk about that. So for simplicity, we'll assume that all the formulas phi that you have are conjunctions of ground facts in that theory. So let me start with decision procedure for linear arithmetic. So the ground facts that we are considering have the form E greater than equal to 0 or E not equal to 0, where the expression E is either a variable Y or a constant C, or you can add or subtract two expressions or multiply an expression by a constant. Now note that I don't need equality, because equality is kind of redundant. I can encode equality by saying, E greater than or equal to 0 and E less than or equal to 0. Now, the decision problem for integer case, in which I'm trying to find satisfying assignments to these variables over integers, is NP-hard. The decision problem in which I'm trying to find satisfying assignment for a conjunction of such facts, where I'm allowed to choose rational values for the variables, is in polynomial time. But the polynomial time algorithms are actually quite complicated to implement. And most of them are actually geometric algorithms. So one such algorithm that I know is the ellipsoid algorithm. Instead, people use an algorithm called simplex, which is a worst-case exponential time algorithm, but it works quite well in practice. On the next two slides, we'll study a polynomial time algorithm, not for rational linear arithmetic, but even a special case of it, which is quite often used, and it is called difference constraints. So difference constraints are constraints of the form x, a variable x is less than or equal to some constant, or the difference of two variables is less than or equal to some constant. And we can, without loss of generality, assume that you only have x minus y less than or equal to c, because x less than or equal to c can be encoded as x minus u less than or equal to c, where u is some special zero variable. So for the point of view of our discussion, we'll assume that the only constraints that you have are of the form x minus y less than or equal to c. So why is this a worthy enough domain to be studied just by itself? Because people have observed that discovering several invariants can actually be written down in this fragment of linear arithmetic. So it would be good if you can design efficient algorithms for reasoning about such facts. So the only reason that you require actually to reason about these facts is given by this transitivity axiom, and you don't need any other reasoning. So if x minus y is less than or equal to c1 and y minus z is less than or equal to c2, then you can conclude that x minus z is less than or equal to c1 plus c2. So the decision procedure for this fragment is actually based upon applying or generating new facts based upon this axiom. And this is essentially the decision procedure. So what you do is you represent the constraints by an n cross n matrix, where n is the number of variables in your system. And the ith and jth entry of that matrix denotes the constant c, where xi minus xj is less than equal to be c. And all that you do is, so I'm going to ask you a question at the end here, right? So you should all be attentive. So all that you do is you carefully apply this rule and keep repeatedly applying this rule and updating the I, jth entry by saying m of I, j is min of the bound that you already know, or a new bound that you can deduce via transitivity from the variable xk, and until you reach saturation. And this can be done in n cube steps. And this is very similar to how you compute shortest path, all pair shortest path. Right? So let's say we have done this. Right? Now what? Now how shall I decide whether the input formula phi is satisfiable or not? I have almost given you the algorithm. What you just have to tell me is that what observation should I make on the resultant matrix M to conclude whether the input formula was satisfiable or not? I'm not even asking for a satisfying assignment. I'm just asking for a Boolean question. So do people understand the real core intuition behind the algorithm? Exactly, right? So we have to check for all the entries. If we find any entry whose value is less than zero, so that's really the representation of unsatisfiability, or the logical fact false in our data structure, right? Because all that our data structure was encoding was facts like this. So how do you encode false using a fact like this? Well, if I say x minus x is less than zero, right? And x minus x can never be less than 0, right? If I can conclude a fact of the form x minus x is less than 0, it's like a representation of false. And this is how that representation would come up if the original set of ground facts was unsatisfiable. So that's the decision procedure for difference constraints. Shall we go on to another theory, which is also very useful? So the theory of uninterpreted functions has facts of the form e1 equals e2 or e1 not equals e2, where the expression e is either a variable x or a binary uninterpreted function symbol f, which is applied to e1 and e2. And the theory of uninterpreted functions has almost no axioms, no interpretation associated with the function f, except the congruence axiom, which says that you can prove that two terms are equal if you can prove that the corresponding arguments are equal. So if e1 equals e1 prime and e2 equals e2 prime, you can prove that f of e1 comma e2 is equal to f of e1 prime comma e2 prime. So why are uninterpreted functions important to be studied as a logic for reasoning about programs? Because they can be used to, for example, model fields of data structures, number one. They can be used to model procedures which have no side effects. They can be used to model any operator without side effects, if you don't want to come up with a precise reasoning for that operator, because reasoning over operators like multiplication is going to be quite hard. So one simple thing that you can do in such cases is to just model the operator as uninterpreted function so that at least you get this much of reasoning out of it. So that's why uninterpreted functions is a very popular choice for reasoning about several different constructs in real programs. Again, observe that the Decision procedure is again quite saturation based. So what we do is, so this is the Decision procedure essentially, and I'll also show you an example. So what you do is you represent the equalities E1 equals E2 in an equivalence DAG. So I will give you an example of this data structure. And the nodes of an EDAG essentially represent the congruence classes of the expressions that are known to be equal. And then you saturate the equalities in the EDAG, inspired by this axiom. So the rule that you use is that if two expressions, E1 and E1 prime, belong to the same congruence class, and expressions E2 and E2 prime also belong to the same congruence class, then you can put F of E1 E2 and F of E1 prime E2 prime also in the same congruence class. So let me actually show you an example. Okay. Yeah, so once we run this algorithm, how do we check whether the system is unsatisfiable? What do you think is the representation of false in this data structure? So this data structure explicitly represents equalities of any two expressions, because all that you have here is variables and some uninterpreted function f applied to it, which you represent using an EDAG. And each node of that EDAG represents all the terms that are known to be equal. Exactly, beautiful observation, right? So even in describing this algorithm, we didn't even make use of any disequality, which suggests that if we started with a bunch of atomic facts which had no disequality, they will all be satisfiable. So unsatisfiability can only arise if you have at least one disequality, and all that you have to check after you do the saturation is to see if there existed some disequality in the ground facts that you had, which are now known to be in the same equivalence class. Okay. So let's take in. So let's take an example. So is this satisfiable or unsatisfiable, this formula? So don't look at the diagram on the right side. Just look at this formula and tell me, is this satisfiable or not? It's unsatisfiable, but it's difficult to reason about. So let's try to run this algorithm and see how we can check unsatisfiability. So the first thing that I have to do is to represent all the terms that are there in the formula. So f to the 5 of y is essentially the superset of all the terms. It describes all the terms that occur in this formula. And now let me simply add the equalities that I know. So y is known to be equal to f cube of y. So I represent that by this dotted or dashed edge. Similarly, y is known to be equal to f to the 5 of y, which I represent like this. And now I will simply apply the congruence axiom. So in particular, from this equality, I can deduce that f of y equals f to the 4 of y, which I denote by this blue edge. So any two nodes that are reachable from these edges are known to be equal. So this is the semantics of the data structure. They belong to the same congruence class. And again, I can conclude that f to the y is equal to f to the 5 of y, which I show by this red edge. And now I can apply transitivity to conclude this. But note, I didn't have to do anything here. The reason is that this represents a congruence class. So if three objects belong to the same congruence class, they are already known to be equal, right? So if I'm going to do a paper and a proof like this, then I have to explicitly deduce this step. But this step is already implicitly there. This fact is already implicitly represented in the EDAG, so I don't have to draw a new edge. Now I can conclude that f of y equals f cube of y, for which I represent this by green edge. And then I again use transitivity to deduce this, but this fact is already represented there. And now you see that I have a fact which is contradicted by one of the known disequalities. So I claim that this is unsatisfiable. So this is quite a classic data structure that can be used to efficiently implement this check. So the complexity of this algorithm is actually worth mentioning. So this runs in n log n time, where n is the size of the input formula. And the reason is that in each step of the algorithm, we at least merge two congruence classes. So there are at most n congruence classes to merge. And each merge can be implemented in log n time if you use a union find based data structure. So, initiate a question. Difference constraints?
Yeah, the difference constraints.
paper that I had at some point that has a very similar set of expressions and a polynomial algorithm for deciding. And I see that in this paper we have multiple variables. So can this be generalized so you can have x minus y minus z, etc., is less than or equal to c1? Is that a straightforward paper?
No.
I'm trying to see the two are.
No, so they're not. So very good question, right? So there's a strict superset of this logic which is called unit constraints, in which the coefficients of both the variables are plus minus 1. And so you can also have, plus minus x plus minus y less than or equal to c. Now this is difference constraints, in which the coefficient of the first variable is plus 1. And this is actually very important for the applying this saturation principle. So a slightly strict superset is what is called unit constraints or octagonal constraints. And what you are referring to is an octahedron constraints, or maybe I'm swapping the two terms, in which I can have multiple variables, but the coefficients of all of them are going to be plus and minus 1. And they are a strict superset of this logic. So this algorithm will not naively work there, because if you try to naively use saturation there, if you can have arbitrary number of variables, then the total number of facts that you can deduce will be exponential. But here, the maximum number of facts that you can deduce is going to be n cubed, because if you have more than n cubed facts, then one of the facts is strictly stronger than the other fact, and you can replace it by the stronger fact. And this is what is really happening in this min thing here. So that's why saturation works here. And but saturation may not always work. So most of the decision procedures that we'll study today are based on saturation. But I personally feel that it is the real intelligence that goes into coming up with decision procedures are the ones that are not based on saturation, which I'm not sure the one that you're looking at is non-saturation based or not. But the ellipsoid algorithm, the simplex algorithm, these are what I call non-trivial decision procedures, and they're all based not on saturation, but some other deep insight about the domain. But the only reason why I'm only covering saturation is because this is what is mostly important. And there are other theories also which very well, work with saturation also. So does it answer your question?
Yeah. I can ask you more about that.
Okay. Now let's talk about the combination of linear arithmetic and uninterpreted functions. So the facts that we have here are again, E greater than or equal to 0 or E not equal to 0, something similar to what we had in linear arithmetic. But now the language of expressions is richer, because besides arithmetic terms, we also have uninterpreted terms mixed there. So the axioms that you need to reason about this thing are the combined axioms of linear arithmetic and uninterpreted functions. And the decision procedure that I'm going to talk about is based upon a classic Nelson-Oppmann combination methodology, which takes the decision procedure for arithmetic, which takes the decision procedure for uninterpreted functions, almost uses it as a black box, and then gives you a decision procedure for the combination of the two theories. So I probably don't have much time to go into these detailed discussions, but this Nelson-Oppmann combination methodology is actually more general than just combining linear arithmetic and uninterpreted functions. It works for combining the decision procedures of any two theories, and these are the conditions that the two theories need to satisfy in order for you to be able to combine those decision procedures. But I'll probably actually skip the formal mention of these conditions, but I will actually directly jump to the algorithm. Okay. Because my goal is to just give you the key insight, key tricks that these algorithms have, rather than tell you why these algorithms are complete or give you a formal proof of correctness. So the first step in deciding a formula that is in combination of two theories is to actually split the formula into two parts such that each of the parts strictly belongs to one theory. And you can do this by introducing some new temporary variables, and we'll take an example on the next slide. And then what you simply do is you simply exchange variable equalities between the two formulas until no more equalities can be deduced. And once you have done that, then you say that the formula is unsatisfiable if and only if one of the individual components is unsatisfiable, which you can check by running the decision procedures for the individual theories on these two formulas. So we'll take an example. So this is a formula that is in the combined theory of arithmetic and uninterpreted functions. So is this formula satisfiable or unsatisfiable? So by now you must, so actually it's not so easy to answer, right? That's why we'll run the algorithm on this. But by now you should have realized that the interesting examples are ones which are unsatisfiable, because that's what we are discussing here. I'm showing you how unsatisfiability is there. So your natural response should be that any example that I have has got to be unsatisfiable. So this formula is not a pure formula yet, because we have a term that uses both f and subtraction. So we need to purify this formula. And that you can do by introducing some temporary variables. So let's say a1 denotes 2y2 minus y1. And if that be the case, then I can rewrite. I have nesting of the theories. So minus is occurring inside f, and f is occurring inside less than equal to. So the theories are nesting two times. So I'll need another temporary variable to denote the term f of a1. And now I can just write on the formula using these temporary variables a1 and a2, such that on one side I get a formula which is only using arithmetic, and on the other side I get a formula which is using uninterpreted functions only. So this is just a syntactical step. You can do this in linear time. Now what we need to do is to exchange variable equalities between the two boxes. So can you prove that any two variables are equal here, or can you prove that any two variables are equal on the other side? Yes, that's true. So you communicate this information to the left side. Now can you prove that any variables, two variables are equal here? Good. Yes. So you communicate that information back forth. Do you get a new equality here? Yes. Or y1 equals, a2 is the same thing, because y1 and a1 are already known to be equal. And now can you deduce any new equality? No, we have reached saturation. So now, is any one of them unsatisfiable? There's only one disequality in one place, so probably. Yes, because y1 equals a2, so by sandwich theorem, it got to be the same. So that's a disequality. And therefore, we conclude that the overall formula is unsatisfiable. So wasn't it a cool algorithm? We were just sharing variable equalities, and then we used individual decision procedures in almost black box manner. And this is called a modular construction of decision procedures. And this is actually a very desirable feature, because today you come up with some logic, you find that it's useful, you develop a decision procedure for it. Tomorrow you might want the need to have a decision procedure for some other logic, and it would be great if you can have a modular construction that can combine the power of two different decision procedures. But it's not always possible, because you saw that there were three conditions, which I skipped over. But you can read those things from my slides, which I will make available. And the real logics that you would like to combine, unfortunately, will not satisfy those conditions. And the way to fix this algorithm in order to be able to give you precise answers is to share more information between the two theories. Instead of just variable equalities, you need to share more information. Okay, now I have a slide each of these things, and then I will conclude for the day. So the theory of arrays. So the theory of arrays has two kinds of facts, equalities and disequalities, very much like uninterpreted function. It's exactly like uninterpreted function, except that you have an additional axiom, which is the select update axiom. Actually, let me actually explain you the language of expressions there. So I have a memory variable M, which represents an array. So it's either some original array variable, or it is obtained by updating some memory variable, where I update the index given by e1, and I write the value e2 there. So update of m e1 e2 denotes a memory that is obtained from memory m by updating the location e1 with the value e2. And the expressions e are either program variables, or obtained by reading the value of memory m at location e. So you can convert a straight line program or a loop field program that is just using arrays, using select update expressions, and this is very standard. And the axiom that select update satisfies, which you should check carefully to make sure that you understand the real semantics of select update, is that if I select the value of e3 from the memory that is represented by this update expression, then the value of e3 will be same as e2 if e1 was equal to e3, because the meaning of this term represents the memory that is obtained by updating memory f and writing E2 at location E1. So if I read at location E3 and E3 was same as E1, then I will get the value E2. Otherwise, I will get the value which was originally inside the old memory F. Right? So this is the axiom of select and update. So this axiom is on top of the congruence axiom that we saw for uninterpreted functions. So it has an additional axiom. That's why it's not an uninterpreted function, right? It has some meaning associated with it. Select and update are not uninterpreted functions. They have some meaning associated with them. Now the addition problem is actually NP-complete. But here is the key idea behind the addition procedure. So what we do is we use this rule to rewrite any select operator that is applied to an update operator in the language of ground facts that I start with. So I have a ground formula, conjunctions of atomic facts in this language. And then what I do is, whenever I see a select on top of update, I do a case split and I generate these two facts explicitly. And this is what is really happening, is kind of some kind of normalization. And once I do that, then I will get a formula with disjunctions because of the case split. But then I can treat select and update almost as uninterpreted functions. And I can apply the algorithm that we discussed for uninterpreted functions, the nice EDAG algorithm. Right? Because once we do this normalization, then you do not need any more reasoning for select and update. All the reasoning that you needed, you are able to do it by doing this kind of normalization. Right? So that's the only slide that I have on theory of arrays. So does everyone understand this? Do you have any questions? Well, I suppose you have theory of lists. Okay, so theory of lists, yeah. So now in theory of lists, the facts that we have are of the form that, so let's assume that we have a list, there's only one field F or a field next, and the only facts that we have are that E2 lies between E1 and E3. So you can reach from E1 to E3 using the link F, and E2 will belong, E2 will be found in between. So you can go from E3, E1 to E3 via E2. So this is a between axiom. Now this axiom can easily be used to encode reachability, which some of you might be familiar with, which says that E1 can reach E2 by following the field F. The reason why I picked this particular fragment of logic, which was recently described, I think in Popple 2008, is because this logic is actually closest under weakest precondition. And this is one of the properties that you want for your logic to have, so that you can reason about straight line programs or loop free programs. If you just include reachability, then it is not closed under weakest precondition. So that's why it's desirable to study a stricture subset of reachability, which includes this between axiom. Now, this logic, the axioms of this logic cannot even be written down using first order formulas. The way we were able to do it for arrays, uninterpreted functions, we were able to write down first-order formulas that characterize the semantics of the operators in that logic. Here, unfortunately, you can't even do that. But still, the cool result is that the addition problem is still NP-complete. And the addition procedure involves, again, doing some kind of saturation using these derivation rules. And there are like six or seven more of them. Now, an example of such a derivation rule is that if x can reach y, then either x be equal to y, or you can reach y from x dot f. And this is, I think, the, no, I think I have the same axiom written here. So what this is really saying is that if you can reach from x to y and you can reach from x to z, then it is either the case that y comes before you reach z or z comes before you reach y. And the cool thing about this algorithm is, so what can go wrong when you do saturation? So this is one important observation about this algorithm. So when you do saturation, the problem is that you can keep introducing new terms. But this algorithm says that you only saturate as long as you can derive facts without creating any new terms. And this thing is very important because otherwise your algorithm will not terminate. You will keep creating a new terms and you can keep saturating more and more. So let's just go back and look for each of the addition procedures that we studied. Was this a problem? So for linear arithmetic, no. There were already a bounded number of facts, n cube facts. For uninterpreted functions, no, because we were operating on an EDAG data structure. We were not creating any new terms there. Theory of arrays, well, it doesn't work by saturation. It works by normalization. So you did not create new terms. Here, the algorithm especially says that you should not create any new terms. You should apply the rewrite rules only when you don't create new terms. But the cool part is that still you can prove completeness. So this is actually quite tricky to prove. But this is pretty much the algorithm for theory of lists. And before I conclude, I will talk about one other important domain, which is linear, non-linear arithmetic. So here, the atomic facts can again be thought of as linear facts over nonlinear terms. So this is how I am actually trying to cast this particular logic. So I have facts which are just greater than or equal to 0 or not equal to 0, but the expression E, instead of being a linear arithmetic expression, it can also involve some nonlinear operators, which I'm referring to as NL of even comma E2. Now, the axioms for these nonlinear operators can be provided by, let's say, the user. An example of such axioms would be that the user can say, if they're interested in reasoning about exponentiation, they can say that if E1 is less than or equal to E2 plus C, then we can conclude that 2 to the power E1 is less than or equal to 2 to the power E2 multiplied by 2 to the C. So what I'm really doing here is that the user is trying to write down some axioms for the exponentiation operator. Or the user can also try to write down some axioms for the logarithm operator. E1 is less than or equal to C times C2. From here, you can conclude that log of E1 is less than or equal to log of C plus log of E2. And in fact, the reason why I specifically picked up this particular approach or decision procedure that I will show you is because if you don't know the decision procedure for your logic, this is a very generic technique that you can use to reason about pretty much any operator. So the key idea is that you ask the user to provide some kind of partial axiomatization of the operators that you want to reason about. And then this is the algorithm that you use. You simply saturate using the axioms. But as I said, the problem in saturation would be that you will be deducing in new and new terms, and your algorithm will never terminate, unless you can prove some completeness results that you don't need to saturate if you're creating new terms. And this is the kind of result that you can prove for the between predicate that I talked about, but you cannot prove that in general. So here is one heuristic, which we call expression abstraction, akin to predicate abstraction, where the user will give you the important set of expressions also. So the user not only gives you the important set of axioms, but the user also provides you an important set of expressions. And what you simply do is that you restrict your new fact deduction to this given set of expressions, which are provided by the user. Or you can construct these expressions heuristically from the program syntax. So let me just actually recap the key ideas that we saw in the logics for different theories. So there were two main ideas. One is what I call normalization, and the other one which I call saturation. So, but when you do saturation, there's always this issue about creating new terms. So either you saturate without creating new terms, that gives you an algorithm, or you heuristically decide which are the new terms you want to create, because otherwise you will only get a semi-algorithm. Your algorithm may not terminate. Linear arithmetic is the only example that I know of which has non-saturation-based decision procedures. I talked about a saturation decision procedure for difference constraints, but if you go over more general fragments, you will see algorithms like ellipsoid and simplex, and they're really cool algorithms, and they work, they really exploit properties of those domains. But most of the other algorithms that we saw were pretty much using some fundamental set of principles. So for example, uninterpreted functions, we were simply doing saturation using the axiom for uninterpreted functions, which is called the congruence axiom. And the tricky part there was how to do it efficiently using an EDAC data structure. Because if you're not careful, you will not get an N log N algorithm. So this was really the heart of this algorithm. For the combination, the interesting part was how to get a decision procedure which is constructed modularly from the decision procedures for the individual theories. And the key idea there was to share variable equalities between the two domains. For theory of arrays, we in fact used the idea of normalization, where we were normalizing the set of equations. Whenever we saw select on top of an update, we rewrote it. For theory of lists, again, we used saturation under the provision that we are not going to create a new set of terms. And the surprising thing was that you can prove completeness of such an algorithm. For nonlinear arithmetic, this is the most hacky part, where we said the user provides the axioms, the user also provides the set of expressions, and then you do saturation over these. But pretty much two key ideas, normalization and saturation. And these are some of the references for the material that I covered. So this book, Decision Procedures, which I came across recently, describes the decision procedures for arithmetic, uninterpreted functions, combination, arrays, and it also gives decision procedures for bit vectors. So this is something that I did not cover. This is a recent paper which talks about the between predicate, and the specific reason I chose this particular instance that can capture reachability is because this logic is closed under weakest precondition. The nonlinear operators was the most heuristic part that I described, and this is from some paper that I wrote up recently, which talks about this notion of expression abstraction. But the reason why I picked up this is because this is a generic methodology that you can always use when you find things to be hard. And this is what I would, the concluding slide of the day. That if you want your decision procedure to be on these slides, the next time whenever I give such a lecture, then you make sure that your decision procedure or the logic has these properties. So you need to identify a class of programs that make use of some domain-specific constructs. Because coming up with one universal logic to express properties of all programs is not going to be possible. You need to understand your domain, and you need to pick up a logic properly. For example, you can choose programs that manipulate bit vectors, and you can come up with a logic for bit vectors. Or you can choose programs that manipulate strings, and you can come up with logic for strings. But these problems have been recently covered, so you need to pick up some other domain. Then you need to develop a language of facts, which has the following properties. Now, it should be able to describe some interesting properties of these programs. So this is really the problem that you're trying to solve, and the logic better be able to describe some properties of these programs. It should be closed in the weakest precondition. So this is something that I did not really explain very clearly. But the reason why we want it to be closed in the weakest preconditions is because decision procedures give you the power to reason about loop-free programs. Right? If you have a loop-free program, then it's almost like a formula. And you can reason about its properties using decision procedures. To reason about programs with loops, we need fixed point computation techniques, which is going to be the content of the lecture in the second lecture. And furthermore, you don't want to choose a logic which is undecidable or which is very hard to reason about. It should be amenable to efficient reasoning. And one challenge that you will face, whatever decision procedure you develop for your logic, is to actually prove that it is complete, that it can completely decide the satisfiability or unsatisfiability of formulas, input formulas. Proving soundness is usually easy, but proving completeness is usually the hard part. But even if you are not able to prove completeness, even if it works, another way to check whether your decision procedure is good or not, even if it is not complete, is to just try it out and see if it can prove properties of the programs that you care about. You can just experiment. So one example in that category was this last one that I talked about. Right? It's not a complete procedure, it's just a heuristic based, but it seemed to work well for the benchmark examples that we chose. So that's it. Thanks for your attention. So regarding the assignment, I'll just mention that problems 1 to 5 are what you can try to solve. And if you have time to only solve one problem, I would pick problem 3. Because this is really the problem that we are trying to solve by after understanding all these principles of invariant generation. And one challenge to you would be to come up with, so this problem simply says it gives you 6 different examples, all from real code except one, which is example number Q3, which is quite hypothetical. But all the 6 other examples are from real code, and write a bound for these examples and try to think what principles would you apply to be able to compute bounds for these programs. So we'll also cover some material in lecture 2, and lecture 3 will cover enough material to be able to automatically apply all those principles to be able to automatically compute bounds for these. But you might have your own ideas or new ways of computing bounds for these procedures, and I would be happy to chat with you about that.